Inside Florida Politics, powered by Gatehouse Florida. Welcome, I'm Sarasota Herald Tribune political editor Zach Anderson. George Bennett is still out, so I'll be filling in again as host. We're looking forward to having George back next week, but until then, it's just me and Gatehouse Florida Capitol correspondent John Kennedy. Hey, John.
Yeah, hey, Zach.
Well, John and I didn't get to tag along, but there was a big delegation of Florida officials that went to Israel recently, and that trip has produced some interesting headlines. We'll talk about that today, and we'll also touch on Special Counsel Robert Mueller's first public statement and what the reaction has been from Florida's congressional delegation. I spoke with Sarasota Republican Greg Stube about Mueller's comments, and there's also been reaction from around the state, so we'll get into that. But first, I think I hear some royalty-free music playing. That means it's time for our regular Pick a Number segment. John, do you have a number?
Yeah, we're kind of light on numbers again this week, but my number is 112.
112, all right. Write that down. We'll come back to that at the end of the show. And my number this week is 62.1 billion. I'm going big this week. 62.1 billion. And John had 112. Well, this may be a show about Florida politics, but all the action this week has been in Israel, where much of the state's leadership has spent the last few days on a trip abroad. Participating in the trip is Governor Ron DeSantis and the three other members of the Florida cabinet, along with some top state lawmakers and agency heads. They had a jam-packed schedule, but what may be getting the most attention is the decision to hold a cabinet meeting while they're on the trip. Open government advocates have criticized the meeting, saying it violates the state's sunshine laws. There was a lawsuit filed this week to try and block the meeting from taking place, but it went ahead anyway. John Kennedy, what's the complaint here? Why could it be a legal violation to hold this cabinet meeting in Israel?
Well, yeah, this trip was not really all that well thought out, especially when the idea was that they were going to throw a cabinet meeting in the middle of it. Basically, you know, Article 1 of the Florida Constitution says that all meetings of a collegial body at which public business is to be transacted or discussed must be opened and noticed to the public. Well, the governor and the cabinet, they discussed a wide range of public interest and emergency management, water quality. They heard from a victim of terrorism. Even if they didn't take official action on these items, this meeting is still subject to the constitutional right of access and the state sunshine law. And, you know, state law says that the public must be given a reasonable opportunity to speak on any issue coming before a body for a vote. So, you know, this meeting, yes, it was live streamed over the Florida Channel, and you could watch it on your computer or in the state's Capitol cabinet room, but you couldn't interact with the officials. Now, you know, DeSantis has dismissed this, but, you know, and also the lawsuit itself was ultimately dismissed by a court, basically because they were unable to serve the legal notice to the governor and cabinet because they were in Israel. So, you know, where does it go from here? It's kind of hard to tell. But, you know, on a trip that was filled with symbolism, as this trip to Israel was for DeSantis, it seems to be that, you know, his sensitivity on this public access issue might, you know, been something that DeSantis would have some attention to, that he'd be able to somehow acknowledge that Florida's long history of open meetings is something worth acknowledging. And of course, this, you know, this might be heightened right now because not only do we have a legislature that regularly enacts exemptions to the state's 40-year-old sunshine laws, DeSantis recently talked publicly about having signed a non-disclosure agreement with the FBI that kept him from disclosing the two Florida counties where Russian operatives had hacked into voting systems. Well, you know, just this week when reporters filed public records requests for the non-disclosure agreement, the governor's office responded with the statement, quote, "A search of the executive office of the governor's files produced no documents responsive to your request." Hmm. So all told, you know, the cabinet in Israel adventure is just another nose thumbing at the public's constitutional right of access.
And full disclosure here, Gatehouse Media was part of the lawsuit. There was a number of news organizations that banded together to file this lawsuit. which is not uncommon when it comes to sunshine law violations. You know, I've heard some people argue that the news media is making too much of this. And you mentioned that DeSantis has kind of dismissed this. He called the lawsuit totally baseless. And, you know, maybe it's true that no real critical decisions are being made at this meeting, but there's a reason that these open government laws exist. Holding public meetings that the public can't attend starts to get into problematic territory. So we'll see what happens with this lawsuit. As John mentioned, you know, it was basically dismissed because they couldn't serve the folks because they were in Israel, you know, with the notice of this lawsuit. But it might persist. And I've read that, you know, the First Amendment Foundation is still going to try and get a judgment saying as to whether or not this is legal to do this. So we'll see. Maybe it isn't really a problem. Maybe it was much ado about nothing. But the sunshine laws exist to ensure government transparency and accountability. And I think most people would agree that those are principles that are worth upholding. Well, aside from the controversy over the cabinet meeting, there wasn't a whole lot of news out of this trip in terms of, you know, big, you know, sort of newsworthy actions that were taken. The DeSantis administration is touting a lot of so-called memorandums of understanding that have been signed between the state of Florida and Israel on issues ranging from disaster recovery to space exploration that could lead to some partnerships between Florida and Israel on various things. But there was a lot of sort of ceremonial things that happened as well. I think yesterday DeSantis planted a tree at a place called the John F. Kennedy Peace Forest. So there's that. I don't know if you knew that there was a peace forest named after you, John. But the governor's also meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu today. You know, he's talking about strengthening ties between Florida and Israel. Are these significant developments, or is this trip more about symbolism, John?
Well, these kind of general feel good and enhanced respect between Israel and Florida, that's sort of what these kind of trade missions are about, I guess. It usually involves some sort of prepackaged business deals that are sort of unveiled on the trip. That's always something similar to, you know, what we've seen here with these memorandums of understanding, which, you know, include, as you mentioned, everything between tourism and trade. Space Florida and the Israeli Space Agency have agreed to a pact to share information and, you know, enterprise. And there's another one aimed at promoting technology and business partnerships. But, you know, they're something that, you know, carry a lot of symbolism, I guess, predominantly. I went with Jeb Bush back on his first foreign trip as governor 20 years ago to Mexico. And it's remarkable that the kind of door opening that a Florida chief executive gets, just like we've seen with DeSantis, you know, DeSantis meeting with Netanyahu, Jeb and the delegation met with then president, Mexican president Ernesto Zedillo. And there was a lot of schmoozing with local business leaders, an occasional press conference with the local media, and little access for Florida reporters to the governor.
Pretty similar to past trips. You don't really expect a lot of, like, you know, major substantive actions out of these.
No. And whatever does come out seems to be a little bit, you know, pre-planned. Israel, of course, is a regular stop for Florida governors. Jeb, Charlie Crist, and Rick Scott all went there. And so now it's DeSantis' turn to sort of burnish his foreign policy cred. And he's got some of it from his years in Congress. And he made a point of highlighting his opposition to the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement against Israel over the treatment of its Palestinian population. And he also spent a lot of time emphasizing Israel's fragile security and its place as the lone Western-style democratic state in the Mideast. But, you know, symbolism abounds. And as we mentioned, the trip is something that DeSantis can play up next year during a presidential campaign when President Trump is desperately in need of trying to carry Florida. Jewish voters are 5% of the state's voting base, and they overwhelmingly vote Democratic. But if DeSantis, who did pretty well with them, can move any toward Trump, that could be a success and maybe even, you know, decisive for who carries Florida next year. Here, we have a little bit of sound from DeSantis talking about what his goals were coming into this.
I think that having the meeting here is symbolic of the friendship between Florida and the state of Israel. We've already done a lot on this trip, and we're going to do more over the next day and a half. But I think that the relationship between our state and Israel is very, very strong, and I think we have potential to do even more. So it's a really, really exciting time.
And of course, because a subtext to this trip seems to be about wooing Jewish voters to vote Republican, this is part of a campaign that we talked about a little bit at greater length in last week's podcast, that it's something that seems to come from the White House on down. But here we also have something from the lone Democrat on the cabinet, Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried, who was also the lone Jewish member on the cabinet.
If Israel and the support from America and from Florida doesn't see Republican, doesn't see Democrat, we are here united for the support of Israel, and we will stand firm behind the state.
So that's what it's about. That's what a week in Israel is bringing Floridians back home.
Yeah, and it's interesting. It's not just Republicans. This is a bipartisan delegation. You have Nikki Fried, who is really the head of sort of the Democratic Party in Florida now as the lone statewide elected Democrat. And there are other Democrats on this trip, State Senator Lauren Book. But it does seem, DeSantis talked about the relationship between Florida and Israel. Isn't some of this about the relationship between him and Israel, though, as well, too, and Jewish voters? I mean, you mentioned that, John. I mean, some people have said that this almost seems like something more of like a presidential level visit style visit. And that, maybe this is, kind of dipping him into the toes of foreign policy for maybe a presidential run in 2024. Do you see any of that?
Well, that could be. DeSantis is a smart, aggressive politician and somebody who has himself done pretty well with the Jewish vote in Florida. We had mentioned earlier he got about 35% of the vote when he ran last year. That was about 7% more than what Trump had gotten in 2016. And, you got to remember, too, that DeSantis earlier this year also pushed the cabinet to call for sanctions against Airbnb, which had antagonized a lot of Jews in this country and across the world by delisting Israeli-owned homes in the West Bank. So DeSantis is doing some of those kind of things that that chief executives of a state do that make them look somewhat ready for the national stage. So maybe that's what this is about, too.
Well, he has been pretty savvy politically so far. So we'll see, how this works for him going forward. So while the Florida cabinet was meeting in Israel, special counsel Robert Mueller made his first public statement about his investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election. Mueller reiterated what he said in his 400-page report, saying, if we had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so. So Mueller basically declined to clear Trump on the obstruction of justice issue. He also raised the impeachment issue, noting that Justice Department policy says he can't charge a sitting president with a crime, but there is another way to pursue accusations of presidential misconduct. That would be through Congress and impeachment. He wasn't really saying anything new. He did mention all this in his report. But it was still noteworthy that he felt the need to make a public statement and highlight these particular aspects of his report. And it seems certain to put more momentum behind the impeachment push. It really a lot of even Republicans seem to take this as Mueller kind of, pointing towards that direction. Whether it really changes the debate seems less likely. Aside from Michigan Republican Justin Amash, the GOP has been staunchly against impeachment, and I'm not sure anything Mueller said really changed that. I caught up with Congressman Greg Stube, a Sarasota Republican, a few hours after Mueller's statement and asked him about it. Here's what he had to say.
I think the American people want us to work on real issues. I think they want us to work together to get things done in Washington and not be focused on continuing to investigate a president who went through a very transparent investigation for 2 years, 22 months, $25 million, 2,800 subpoenas, 500 witness interviews, 500 search warrants to come to a conclusion, which for the last 2 years, it's been, the Trump campaign's colluded with Russia. And that was the whole basis of the investigation to begin with. And that found very clearly that didn't occur.
So it seems obvious that Stubbe doesn't believe Mueller's comments really changed anything. And his thoughts are particularly noteworthy because he sits on the House Judiciary Committee, which is where articles of impeachment must originate. So he could be faced with casting a vote on this before most other lawmakers. And he's definitely against voting for impeachment. Another congressman from Florida who sits on the Judiciary Committee had a much different take. Boca Raton Congressman Ted Deutsch came out and tweeted that, quote, Mueller found obstruction and now the White House is part of an ongoing cover up. He also said that Congress needs to conduct an inquiry into whether Trump, quote, violated his oath of office, broke the public trust, and committed high crimes and misdemeanors. High crimes and misdemeanors seems like an obvious reference to potential impeachment there. So, the Democrat reaction to Mueller's comments, much different than the Republican reaction. Congressman Charlie Crist from St. Petersburg also put out a statement. He's a Democrat. He said, quote, as special counsel Mueller passes the torch, we must ensure justice is carried out by continuing our congressional investigations to get the whole truth and nothing but the truth. The American people deserve nothing less. So not necessarily, everybody immediately crying for impeachment proceedings to begin, but certainly hinting at it on the Democratic side. John Kennedy, What do you think? I mean, is Mueller's comments going to add a little bit more momentum to the impeachment push here?
Oh, I think it absolutely will. I think that pressure is going to heighten as more people get an opportunity to stew on this for a while. And I think you're going to see the House Democrats that are leaning toward pushing for impeachment enhancing their call right now for action. Nancy Pelosi, the House Democratic leader, seems to be somebody who, has been trying to distance herself and to try to keep the chamber that she is the speaker of from going down this path. But it's going to be harder and harder, I think, to stay away from that. Now, there is something of a middle ground that you hear being discussed as well, where somehow the Congress could continue an investigation of the all matters related to Trump, so, stopping short of a full impeachment process, which could take a very long time to roll out. So this investigation idea is something that's a little bit of a lesser step, but could still get out a lot of the information that is part of the Mueller report, and also bring a lot of Trump's inner circle subpoenaed before Congress. So maybe that is what we see unspooling, something short of impeachment, which does seem to be, doomed to failure because the Republican-led Senate has no interest in acting on impeachment.
Yeah, I think you're right, John. I think you're definitely going to see much more aggressive. There's already been really aggressive investigative efforts by Democrats, but I think you'll see them ramp that up and some big confrontations with the White House, over some of this. But it's interesting. Stubbe did not, he still seems skeptical of impeachment. He's very much against impeachment, but he seems skeptical that Democrats are really going to go forward with it, even after this Mueller statement. He noted to me that there's 31 Democratic members in Congress who are in districts that Trump won that are Republican leaning districts. And, they would really be in the hot seat on the impeachment issue. And it could be something that would be a drag on their campaigns. And, Pelosi is very savvy. She wants to keep control of the House. She's very cognizant of how that could affect these members, including some folks in Florida, like Stephanie Murphy in the Orlando area. So, I'm not quite sure that this is going to lead to impeachment. Although if they do it, they have to do it fairly quickly. I don't think they're going to issue articles of impeachment next year during an election year. It would probably be in the next few months. So we'll see. Maybe they ramp up investigations, and if something comes out of those investigations, then they decide on an impeachment. But certainly some pretty interesting reaction to Mueller's statement there. Well, that wraps up our show this week. We're going to move on to our final segment, pick a number. John, I believe your number was 112. You want to explain what that means?
Yeah, my 112, that's the number of bills that have been approved by the legislature, but which have still not been yet sent to Governor DeSantis for his approval or disapproval. You know, among them is the biggest bill of all. That's the state's $91.1 billion budget, which the governor has already warned that he plans to veto back to below $91 billion. Now, DeSantis has acted on a fair bit of legislation. He's approved 77 bills, and he's vetoed two. But as you can see, he's less than halfway finished with action taken from this session, which ended almost a month ago. Now, there's no real deadline for legislators to send the governor the bills that they've approved. Sometimes strategy is involved. You know, if there's a particularly controversial bill or budget items that could be vetoed, there can be a delay while lawmakers try to get people to work the governor, basically. You know, emails and phone calls suggesting that there's a groundswell of support for something, trying to get him to, not veto something that maybe they fear he would veto. This time around, though, there doesn't seem to be much of a strategy. It just seems to be taking a very long time. By contrast, last year, an election year, when then-Governor Rick Scott was ready to start running full-time for Senate, things were completely different. Lawmakers, also were looking to get out on the campaign trail at that time as well. And Scott signed the last of the bills 1 month after lawmakers broke. Basically, this time last year, Scott was basically done, and he'd signed the budget itself just 5 days after lawmakers had approved it. But this year, DeSantis's Israel trip has been sort of a slowdown. And otherwise, it just seems no one is really in that much of an interest to button up everything from the 2 month session. So here we are. We're still in sort of a limbo.
Yeah, they got to hurry back from Israel. There's still a lot to do.
Still
and I know
a lot to do.
I know with the budget outstanding, I talk to people about, what's in the budget, and they're sort of hesitant to talk too much about it because they don't want to, they don't want to say anything before the budget is finalized. So a lot of people are still looking to that and what DeSantis is going to veto and what he's not. There's, still a lot of intrigue there. So we'll see what happens with that. Well, my number was $62.1 billion. That is the preliminary value of all the property in Sarasota County. And it's an interesting number. Statewide, these preliminary property value estimates are coming in for local governments. They're pretty important. They are used to basically, set the budget for local governments for the upcoming year. They're important for local school districts, which are funded in part by property taxes. And it's interesting, Sarasota County's property values continued to climb, as are county property values around the state. In Sarasota, they rose 6.2% over the last year, according to an article that by my colleague Barbara Peter-Smith. And that was a $3.6 billion increase. So pretty important for local governments and a sign of health for the local economy that property values continue to rise. An interesting tidbit, though, Sarasota County's property values are still below what they were at their peak in 2007, 12 years ago. It has taken us 12 years to recover from the Great Recession, the massive real estate collapse that we had in that Great Recession. It just shows you what a cataclysmic event that was for Florida property owners and property values. So we still have not recovered. The all-time record in 2007 was $62.6 billion. So we're about $500 million below that right now. Probably eclipse it next year. Which means it will have taken, again, 13 years to fully recover the property values from the Great Recession. So just a note on kind of where we were and where we are right now, but an important number for, again, for local governments and for the economy in Florida. Well, that finishes our show this week. I want to thank everyone for listening. I also want to thank the audio production team of Thomas Forty, Joseph Forzano, and Adam Fish. George Bennett will be back next week. Until then, we're out of here.